I am Charles Weygandt, and today is August the 4th, 1977, and I am in the office of Mr. William L. Adams at 1519 Pennsylvania Avenue. Mr. Adams, would you please give us the date and place of your birth?
I was born in North Carolina, January 5th, 1914.
Why did you leave North Carolina, and at what age?
I left North Carolina at the age of 15 years old. I was working on the farm, and I thought I wanted to change to city life. So I had an uncle here in Baltimore. I came to live with him.
Were you very conscious of race prejudice in North Carolina?
Not to any degree, more so than I found in Baltimore when I came here. I had heard about Baltimore and the North being so liberal and what have you, but really myself, I found no difference, because I lived in a small town called Zebulon, North Carolina, 21 miles outside of the capital, with Raleigh. And I played with the white kids there. We shot marbles together and what have you. And then I came to Baltimore. It was no different. I couldn't go to any of the places here. It was segregated movies here, same as in the South there. At least some of the theaters, they had the blacks upstairs and the whites downstairs. But they were in the same building.
They did that in churches too, didn't they, in some communities?
I don't know about churches, because I don't. It was a small town when I was young, and it didn't. They didn't do that in the Zeppelin where I.
All right. Now you were an ambitious young fella coming along. Did you find doors closed to you that you would have liked to have had open, that reacted? You know, that stopped you in your progress to advance yourself.
Well, now you're speaking about since I've been here in Maryland.
Yeah, right.
Well, when I came here, and just about all of the doors were closed.
Yeah.
Except I worked in a rag shop. That was open.
What kind of work did you do in a rag shop?
Well, packing the bins and old mail bags that would have leather on them. We had a machine to cut the leather and separate it from the canvas. Mm-hmm. I made $6 a week.
Wow.
I was making more than that in North Carolina.
You're making more than that on a farm?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was making more than that working on the farm.
And $6 a week represented how many hours of labor?
I really don't recall. I'm going back to 1930. I think we worked a half day on Saturday. I think we worked 5.5 days a week then, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Well,
at least, I don't know, it was 10 hours, at least 8 or 10 hours a day.
All right, well, you were coming on the scene then about the time of the Depression here.
Absolutely, right at the beginning of it.
Could you make any comment about conditions here during that period of time?
Well, the only thing I can say that there were too many jobs. All the jobs that I would know anything about was more or less people working at Ferris Point. I lived in East Baltimore, and that was the industrial part of the city, and people working in industry, but it was many people out of work. In fact, I said that was about the beginning, and as 31, 32, 33 on, you know, it got worse. People really had no work. It was hard, that's all.
Was the unemployment worse among the blacks than the whites, did you find, or?
Oh, I really couldn't answer that, but my opinion would be that it's always been that way as far as employment is concerned. It's even that way today, so I assume it was that way during the early 30s.
Were you in any way involved in the youth movement among the blacks who launched this Buy Where You Can Work campaign in the early 1930s? Do you recall that?
Well, I recall here on Pennsylvania Avenue in the late 30s, in fact, I helped to raise funds to pay people to walk the streets up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, requesting jobs have a place to work if you spend your money there. That was started by a fella that Miss Lily Jackson was the instigator in bringing here in the 30s.
Who was that? Do you know the name of the person?
I do not know the gentleman's name, but he came out of New York here. And he had had experience in that deal, and that's why they brought him here.
So in other words, you were raising money for this NAACP activity, a Buy Where You Can Work, or was it an NAAC activity, as you recall?
This itself, I don't think, was an NAACP, but it was all coordinated through the NAACP. And I'd say the NAACP had to have something to do with it, but it's, you know, going back into the 30s, but I just remember Ms. Jackson was head of it, Lily Jackson, and happened to bring this gentleman here, and he organized the people to walk and to picket the stores for employment, because on Pennsylvania Avenue here, you spend your money, but you had no jobs in the stores. And this was then a totally black community, except for the store owners and the merchants.
Right. When did you first become involved with the NAACP or the civil rights movement?
Well, I don't think they called it the civil rights movement during those days.
They didn't, yeah.
I think that came later. It was just because we had one organization, and that was NAACP, and it just wasn't no other organizations during, even up through the 40s. I don't think there were, except that did come about the Urban League, which worked more or less in another area, because they tried to open doors for employment and stayed in that area during the 40s.
Well, did you become a member of the NAACP in the 1930s?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I became a member of the NAACP, and in fact, I worked with the NAACP as a fundraiser throughout the 40s and probably early into the early 50s.
When did you first meet Lily Mae Jackson?
In the late 30s.
What would you say was her primary contribution to the civil rights movement?
Well, during the 30s and even the early 40s, it wasn't much you could do but speak out. And most of the blacks were afraid to speak out because if it was someone that had a job, as a teacher or whatnot, they didn't want to get involved because they're afraid to lose the job. But in the position that Lily Jackson held as NAACP director, she was able to voice herself, and she really spoke out. And that's what she was known for during those years, that other blacks wasn't in a position, probably due to their jobs, the fear of losing their jobs. And Lily was in an independent position through the NAACP, and she was a lady, that just had the willpower to do it anyway. And it was hard to speak out during those days if you were black. She was noted mostly for that throughout her career, speaking out. And we said holler. You were ready to holler. But Lily would holler. She would let the people know that the people weren't satisfied and they weren't being treated right, as far as blacks were concerned.
What was her period of greatest effectiveness, would you say?
I don't know how effective really the program was. Because even though you could holler during those days, nobody really heard you too much except in one year and out the other.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it made noise and let the powers be to know that there were people dissatisfied.
Now, she was president, though, of the NAACP from 1935 to 1970, and of course, from 1954 on, there were great advances in the area of civil rights.
Right.
How effective was her hollering, as you call it, once substantial progress began to be made?
State that question again.
I say, you mentioned that her role was sort of as a rallying point. She could give voice
right.
where other people were afraid to give voice
Absolutely.
To the needs of justice among blacks. All right, but I then noted that from 1954 on through part of the 60s anyway, there were great advances in the area of civil rights. So I was saying, how effective was her role of hollering, shall we say, during this later period? The period when advances were being made and when the militants were coming to the fore and so on.
Well, I think from the mid-50s, let's say from the time of the school desegregation on, it was a new area. And actually, voicing your opinion or hollering, it wasn't too effective after that, after the 50s, the mid-50s. Because after the case was won, we know by the NAACP for the school desegregation, which I think was in 54.
Right.
And that was the national body, naturally, the NAACP that
of course
carried
we,
the ball.
We had a local guy very much involved, Thurgood Marshall.
Oh, Thurgood Marshall, yes. And well, Thurgood fought at Houston.
Charlie Houston.
He was a great lawyer. Charlie Houston, I'll say this about him. There were a group of us here in Baltimore that wanted to play golf in the 40s. And we had one little golf course called Carroll Park, Sand Green. Now, this is something we started in 1940-41. It was the only place we could play, and we really weren't satisfied with the golf course. I say we, it was a few of us, myself, Mr. Dixon, and one of Mr.
What Dixon was that?
That's William B. Dixon, an insurance broker and a real estate dealer right up the street here, 1531-33. Then there were Arnett Murphy, Dr. Carl Murphy's brother, Bathro, and myself probably a couple other people. And really what brought this about, Joe Lewis was a good friend of mine, and Joe came to Baltimore 1940 for the Chick Webb's Memorial. It was having a Chick Webb's Memorial at the 5th Regiment Army, and Joe and I were very close. We played golf together, so Joe wanted to play golf. Roger Pipkin called me, who was, I don't know if you remember Roger Pipkin.
The News American, wasn't he?
Yes. And he naturally wanted to interview Joe. So he came out to Carroll Park and played golf with us. Well, it was against the law for white and black to play together. But Rogers came out and took a chance on playing with us. And he said what was a disgrace, the golf course that we had there. And he did a story on it. First. And naturally, Joe Lewis was very popular at that time. So that gave us a little push as far as the golfers were concerned to try to gain our rights to play on the other golf course.
So what happened?
Let's see. Now you're getting in the area of 40-41 around World War II, or let's say from 41 to 45. Well, we went to the NAACP to ask them to take the case. And Mrs. Jackson, she said, well, if you fellows are wealthy enough to play golf, you afford to play golf. You can afford to pay your lawyer yourself.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we raised the fund and we employed some Dallas Nicholas and who he was a lawyer here, very prominent black lawyer at that time. And
Dallas Nicholas?
Dallas Nicholas.
How do you spell Nicholas?
It's N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S.
Yeah, just like it sounds, okay.
Yes, Dallas Nicholas and his associates, they took the case. And we filed a case. And we brought in Houston, what was it, Houston Jackson?
Charles Houston.
We brought him in for the case. And the case was tried in the federal court.
What judge?
I don't really recall the judge's name. Yeah. Like that one. We had the hearing there. And we got a ruling that until they could give us grass greens, they had to permit us to play on all the golf courses. So what happened behind that? So we paid the fees ourselves. Charles Houston at that time was the number one lawyer for the NAACP.
Right.
Marshall, Thurgood Marshall was a young lawyer coming along at
right.
that time under Houston, more or less. So we played golf on the courses until...
Well, didn't you have separate days to play?
Oh,
is that the way it worked?
That's right. We had separate days to play. And at that time, let's see, we had Mount Pleasant was a new golf course, the Clifton Park and Forest Park, the one that we played on, the Sand Greens, was Carroll Park. So they set up a system where we could play on the golf course at certain days. And we had the opportunity each week to play a golf course. Some days it wouldn't be a person on the golf course. It wasn't that big. And during that same period, Joe Lewis, he was stationed at Fort Meade for quite some time. And so we would go out to Mount Pleasant, which Joe was a good golfer, liked to play the best course. We would go out there and have the whole golf course to ourselves. That's our course, out at Mount Pleasant Golf Course. And actually what happened, this was something that really angered the other people, the white people, the golf players, they wanted to play, and they said, my God, if there were any sport that blacks and whites could play together, they would be on a golf course. Plenty of breathing space on the golf course. So...
What happened?
So we were on that way, and the authorities to be, they still wouldn't give. So what happened? We played that way. They wouldn't open up and let the whites come out. So we just had big golf courses. Someday nobody on different courses could. We would still go to Carroll Park. One day a week we'd have to go to Carroll Park. But naturally we couldn't play golf every day. So what happened? Immediately after the officers were signed, this is 1945, I think the world
yeah.
went in. The city officials got busy as they possibly could out at Carroll Park and put in grass greens and sand traps, which was nothing but sand before. You had to put on
yeah.
the sand and everything. No such thing as a trap. You just hit the ball on the, they had the fairways was green, but you put it on the sand. So, so one morning, I guess that would be probably 46, because they couldn't get the materials during the World War II.
Yeah.
The pipes, and the water pipes that you need to run out to the green belt. But anyway, about early 46 or latter 45, without notice, except for very little notice in the paper, it was in there that all blacks back to Carroll Park.
No kidding.
Because now they had a golf course that was equal to the others.
Yeah.
So in court we went again, into federal court. And now I could be wrong. I don't. That could have been the time that we brought Charles Houston in 45 or 46.
You mean the second time?
The second
yeah.
time. That could have been, I believe. I believe that was the second
mm-hmm.
go round. Because they only permitted us to play on the other courses during the time because they said everything wasn't equal. But when they put the grass out there, they said everything was equal. So anyway, I know we went into federal court. And the results was we won the case.
Again.
Again, we won the case, and that was the time when they decided then that they were going to open up all the golf courses and let everybody play them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, in other words, the golf courses were integrated. It must have been one of the first things integrated around here.
The first thing was integrated. We never had any problems.
Do you know what year that was?
Well, it had to be. Now, they put us back at Terrell Park around 46. I know it wasn't no later than 46. Materials were available. And they worked real hard in putting grass greens out there to make it what they call equal. And it could have been, I don't know, we could have been in court, could have been a year or so, a couple of years, I don't know exactly. It's hard.
But you think that the golf courses were all integrated by the end of the 1940s then?
I believe by the 1940s, all of the golf courses. I'm pretty sure all the golf courses here were integrated by that time.
And the NAACP did not play any role at all?
No role at all. Mm-hmm. We did that. On your own? On our own. And it was the first test case. And after that, I think the next case was in Atlanta, Georgia. And they used our case because even though we integrated here, and that was a federal court.
Yeah.
It just didn't open up the golf courses all over, but it made it easy for the other states. And I do recall it was much late on, I think, after our case, but I know Atlanta, Georgia later on opened up their courses. And this was the test case was here in Baltimore of opening the recreation as far as the golf course was concerned for sports.
What did
and
the
we paid for it at that time, but at that time Henry Parks was here. Henry Parks, William Dixon, myself, and Arnett Murphy, we put up $500 each, and then some other people put in as much as they could, $10, $15, $25. Because I think the fee was $2,500, we had to pay the lawyer, the brainchild.
Was the case appealed by the city from the local federal court?
No.
It was not?
No.
Did Lily Mae Jackson give you any kind of moral support or just absolutely nothing?
No, we had no support from the NAACP on that appeal. No.
You said that her greatest effectiveness was really through the first two decades of her regime, you might say, starting in 1935. Well, who became the prime mover in the civil rights movement, as you see it, after that first two decades?
Well, the NAACP as a whole, no question about it, was a strong organization testing all the cases in court, but that was the national NAACP.
Yeah.
And some of the cases naturally was here in Maryland. I think the law school, first law school was open at the University of Maryland for blacks. But really, except testing cases through the NAACP, the civil rights movement did not really get underway until the young people got involved and were determined and started their organizations. That's really when things really start to turn. In fact, let's see now. I might take a step back. Before they started, was Martin Luther King on the scene?
Well, you hear a lot about him, of course, in the 1960s. Now, whether he was active in the late 1950s.
Well, the kids didn't get involved until the 60s. That all started in the 60s.
Yeah.
And it was a great, no question about it, school desegregation, I guess, was one of the greatest victories.
Well, that really got it rolling. That really got it rolling.
That really got it rolling. And it's like anything, you get something started, well, you know, it begins to speed up. But I would say really what got it moving was these kids that were fighting in Vietnam and those places, they were coming back and actually the ones that fought in World War II couldn't do very much because they came back to the same condition here as it was when they left. But after the school desegregation case was won, I think people as a whole just got more involved and were determined. There was determination among the blacks that they just weren't going to stand still anymore. And the young people, I give them credit for carrying the ball.
In other words, you're saying that somewhere after the school desegregation case, that the real thrust of the civil rights movement was no longer in the hands of a Lillie Mae Jackson and NAACP. It was really coming from the more militant younger blacks. Is that right?
Right. And the thing that really gave it a spark, there's no question about it, nationwide, was Martin Luther King. He threw their bus strike in Alabama, what have you. But then he was the nonviolent type. You know, there were violence when the kids started sitting in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah.
They started in Greensboro. And it started mostly around the college where they were, you know, doing the South, where you had these kids going to college, like Greensboro, noted for its A&T college, and then around Raleigh, there was quite a few schools. And I think it really started, the settings, I believe, started down there more so than it did up this way in the beginning.
And then, of course, we had the Route 40 problem here, if you will recall.
I remember that very well. I can't recall the years, but I know I used to go up and down Route 40 many times and couldn't stop at a restaurant nowhere after you got out of Pennsylvania.
And how did you feel about that?
Well, I thought it was terrible, but we couldn't do anything about it.
Did you resent it personally?
Oh, yes, I resented it personally, no question about it. But it was one of those things. Even if you would go on the train to New York up until in the mid-50s of... And if you didn't have an automobile, when you got off the train at Pennsylvania Station and you were black, you would be standing out front trying to get a cab. And as long as the whites would come out, you just did not get a cab.
Were they white drivers then?
Oh, yes.
Only white drivers then?
Only white drivers for the... We had one black company got a few cabs. They couldn't even come to the station because the yellow cab had the... I guess the...
Some kind of a franchise?
But you couldn't even get a... You'd feel so bad, because at least in Philadelphia and New York, you could get a cab, but when you got to Baltimore, Maryland, at the station, you just had a terrible time getting to the station unless you had someone to pick you up. And I do recall very... I don't know the year, but it stays in my mind very well. It was through the Urban League, working with the powers to be, that brought about the change in the cabs and black cab drivers.
How did you feel about the effectiveness of Furman Templeton and the Urban League?
Oh, they did a wonderful job, because they were able, you know, like when Lillie Jackson came along, I said you could holler, and most people were afraid to holler, and she did a wonderful job. Just by her hollering, that let authorities to be and other races know that the people weren't satisfied, but that's all you could do. But however, you take the Urban League through Furman and Templeton and another gentleman there.
Dave Glenn was there for a while, and then there was a man before Furman.
I'm talking about before Furman.
Yeah.
Can't remember his name. I think he left him with Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Now, they were able to get the doors open where they could sit down and talk to the authorities. Probably, when I said authorities, you're talking about the people that own the cabs or whatever industry was. They were trying to open up jobs for blacks. And certainly, like we're sitting here now, we could probably, if we were here trying to resolve a problem about something, if we have an opportunity to sit at the table and discuss it, we'd probably accomplish more than if we couldn't even get together to talk about it.
Right.
One time the doors was closed, you couldn't get in the doors to talk.
So you would say the Urban League was just as effective, if not more, in its own way as the NAACP was?
As far as locally here in Baltimore, opening the doors for jobs and getting blacks in, certainly that was their thing. You know, the NAACP was pretty much in another field altogether, because they were testing cases all the time, more or less in court. The Urban League was working for where the bread was, trying to work on a local level, and through the National Urban League, and were able to reach some of the people that were all big industries, and then the local could go in and work. I remember very well how we got the first black salesman in the liquor industry, as far as the salesman was concerned.
How was that?
And in the beer business also.
How was that?
How was that? Well, in 1935, I opened a tavern called the White Lot on Drood Hill Avenue.
The what? The White?
I opened a tavern
yeah.
at the corner of
White Lock
on Drood Hill Avenue
right.
in 1935. And it was called Little Willie's Inn. For some reason, I was little, they called me Little.
Yeah.
Little Willie.
Right.
That was my nickname. So I opened this tavern, and it was fixed up very nice, considering for those days. Very It wasn't about two black taverns, it was three black taverns. Might have been four black taverns altogether. See, Wendell Wilson, Sugar Hill, Little Willis, and another fellow up the street. Well, three of us right up there together. One was across the street from me called Sugar Hill, and that corner White Lock, and I was on the southwest corner of Little Willis Inn, and then it was one up at a little street called Edmund Street on White Lock. And then Wendell Wilson had tavern at Baker Street. That was about the only black taverns that I can recall in those days. So, but that was in 35, but we're coming up now into the 50s.
Can
you have a